Support for WPR comes from Present Music, performing honest music with guest violist and curator Nadia Sirota, May 9th at 8 at the Milwaukee Art Museum. Tickets and info are at presentmusic.org.
Brian Boyd is the University Distinguished Professor in the Department of English at the University of Auckland. He's also the author of On the Origin of Stories, Evolution, Cognition, and Fiction. In his book, Boyd explores the evolutionary origins of art and storytelling. He told N. Strange Champs how our love of storytelling has helped us evolve.
If you look at great storytelling, you see that it's asking us to shift positions, to get our imagination inside other characters and times, places, even within the one story.
So your book also features a couple of in-depth analyses of two very different literary works, Homer's ancient Greek poem, The Odyssey, and Dr. Seuss's 1954 book, Horton Hears a Who. Using an evolutionary criticism, you call it evo-criticism, what can you tell us about Horton Hears a Who?
One of the things that I stress a lot in the book is the centrality of attention for art. I wanted to show how much work Dr. Seuss has put into engaging the attention of very young readers and of their parents and of people rereading and of people reading over the generations. I point out that the initial impetus for writing Horton Hears a Who was in fact Dr. Seuss's sympathy with Japan and its first post-war election after the U.S. moved out in 53. He had visited Japan in 53. And you can see how this gets into Dr. Seuss. And some critics have actually explained the book in terms of that. But my point is that while that may have been a trigger, Dr. Seuss is really after a much bigger game. He does want a story that's going to last, that is going to become a classic, as it has. And so he's therefore appealing to human universals, and especially, of course, in Dr. Seuss's case, he is just the pure spirit of play. He's using so many devices to make the story as playful as possible. His drawing, those wonderful loopy curves in his characters, the nonsense verse, the clunky rhythms.
On the 15th of May, in the jungle of Newell, in the heat of the day, in the cool of the pool, he was splashing, enjoying the jungle's great joys, when Horton the elephant heard a small noise. So Horton stopped splashing. He looked toward the sound. That's funny, thought Horton. There's no one around. Then he heard it again, just a very faint yelp, as if some tiny person were calling for help.
Dr. Seuss himself, I think, said that the book was very much inspired by that trip to Japan, and that he meant the Who's in Whoville to be kind of a portrait of Japanese society, and that in the end, the sort of message is about voting and the fact that every single person's vote, each person, counts. But you just said that you think that he was going after bigger game in a way. What sort of bigger game?
It's quite a complex social message, actually, because on the one hand, he's certainly saying every voice counts. Little Jojo, who's playing with the yo-yo in Whoville and is not adding his voice to the din, is crucial to making the Who's audible at the end of the story.
When they got to the top, the lad cleared his throat and he shouted out,
"Yap!"
And that yap, that one small extra yap, put it over. Finally, at last, from that speck on that clover, their voices were heard. They rang out clear and clean, and the elephant smiled. "Do you see what I mean? They've proved they are persons, no matter how small. And their whole world was saved by the smallest of all."
Of course, that in a way is almost the reverse of what you get in democracy, where not everybody cries out with the same cry, where they're actually competing cries. And he's also focusing in the story on Horton, the elephant's courage in resisting the pressure of all the other animals to conform to their way of thinking, and Horton doesn't, and of course he's a hero for not doing so. So it's quite a complex social message to be getting into a story for very young kids.
Well, I guess what I'm curious about is whether bringing evolutionary theory together with literary criticism can help you get at what is literary genius. I mean, not all stories are equal. So can using a Darwinian lens help explain what sets a Dr. Seuss apart from Dick and Jane?
I think so. Look at it in terms of attention. We can see that the many devices that Seuss uses on a single page or throughout a whole story that are going to hook the attention of multiple generations in a way that Dick and Jane stories do not. I use another aspect of the Darwinian explanation to talk about the generation of stories. From a Darwinian perspective, every adaptation in a species is a solution to a particular problem that this species has faced in its environment. And I use a problem-solution model as a way of getting very, very close to what decisions writers are making at a particular point in a text. I see a book as a whole series of nested problems and solutions, the initial problem being the capturing of an audience's attention.
So by capturing attention, really what you're looking at is delight. How is it that a story delights us?
Yes, well, it need not only be straightforward delight, although that certainly is the case in Dr. Seuss. It can involve rather tragic emotions as well. I do look at the appeal to universal emotions, universal ways of understanding how other people behave. These may be inflected culturally differently in different circumstances, but most of the really classic stories focus on phases or kinds of decisions in human life, say, that are similar enough across cultural difference for them to be crucial to engage. Our circumstances in choosing romantic partners are now very, very different from those of Jane Austen, but she focuses on that so intensely, on the subtlety of the negotiation between prospective partners, that it still matters to us very much, even though we have now contraception, different values, and so on.
But we still recognize this story and it still speaks to us because it's about the selection of a mate?
Yeah, at that crude level, yes it is. But it's also all the way through her work about being socially sensitive to what other people are doing. I mean, she focuses on how people read people, and nobody does that more intensely than she does. And of course, that's always a skill that's going to matter to all of us at whatever life stage we're at. So I try to refocus people's reading experience on human universals, even though they will be culturally inflected in a particular story. Mm.
So one of the things you're doing is using the power of science to elucidate the power of art, which makes me think of C.P. Snow's famous 1959 lecture, The Two Cultures. You know, Snow argued that the breakdown in communication between modern societies, two different cultures, the sciences and the humanities, was an enormous obstacle to solving the world's problems. So I'm curious to know what you think. Do science and the arts have more in common than we think?
Oh, definitely, yes, in many ways. I think, in fact, many scientists, I've been working with scientists for a while now, have a very good understanding of the arts, much better than artists tend to have of the sciences. I now teach a course in literature and science where we look at it from all kinds of angles. I came across the work of Robert Root Bernstein, a physiologist who studies the role of creativity in the sciences. In scientific discovery, it seems that the imagination and play, things like that that we associate with art, are very, very central. The greatest chemists, for instance, almost imagine themselves at the molecular level when they're reasoning about chemical transformations. And this use of the imagination, instead of getting inside characters, they might get inside physical processes. Or they may think of an answer's satisfactoriness, not in terms of how the calculation comes out, but in terms of the beauty of the answer. And sometimes great scientists have gone for the beauty over what seemed to be the experimental evidence. And then the experimental evidence was shown to be wrong, and the beautiful solution proves to be the right one.
Sort of shows that storytelling kind of underlies so much of what we do, whether it's in the sciences or the arts. Really, it's all a form of storytelling.
Yes, but I very much want to contradict the idea that science is just another form of storytelling, another form of fiction, if you like. It's no more reliable than anything else. I think science has found social ways of coming up with answers that are less likely to be wrong than anything else we do, and when we should treasure that. But I certainly think that there are very powerful things that science and the arts can give to one another.
Brian Boyd is the author of On the Origin of Stories, Evolution, Cognition, and Fiction. He spoke with N. Strange Champs. The excerpts from Horton Hears a Who were read by Dustin Hoffman.